Our next case this morning is number 053260, the United States against BDO Seidman.
May it please the court, I'm Frank Seiler representing the government in this case. My colleague John Lindquist is with me at council table. As a preliminary matter, I note that we are operating under the constraint of an order of this court sealing certain documents which are the subject of this appeal. I'm not sure what those constraints are. I will do my best to make my references as generic as possible. But if the court certainly has any guidance to offer us, we would appreciate it as we go forward. We're here on the second appeal in this summons enforcement proceeding. Government is appealing the district court's holding that certain documents were privileged. The issues before the court, I think, should be informed by the maxim that the public is entitled to every person's testimony. I think that cuts even deeper when we're operating in the context of 6111, 6112 of the Internal Revenue Code, which manifests a very strong public policy in favor of shedding light on the operations of and participants in tax shelters. Congress has gone to great lengths to require that tax shelters be registered in certain cases and that list of participants be maintained and turned over to the IRS. In this case, the district court mistakenly found that some 266-67 documents were subject to the 75-25 federal tax practitioner's privilege. It's law of the case that interveners had the burden of establishing all the elements of that privilege. They didn't do this. One of the elements of the privilege is that it does not apply to written communications with the director, shareholder, officer, agent, or representative of corporation in connection with the direct or indirect participation of the corporation in any tax shelter. And for these purposes, a tax shelter is very broadly defined as, among other things, any plan or arrangement, a significant purpose of which is the avoidance or evasion of income tax. Now, there are two things to note about the exception. First, it suffices if the plan or arrangement is designed to avoid any federal income tax, not, as interveners would have it, just corporate tax. Second, the direct or indirect participation of any corporation in the shelter will suffice. The fact that the participating corporation is an S corporation is simply irrelevant. An S corporation is a corporation. The statute is just very, very clear that the privilege does not apply to a situation in which, to a communication with a representative of a corporation where the corporation is participating in the shelter. It's not a matter of the privilege not applying where corporate taxes are saved, because that's not the way the statute's written. I think it's significant that when you look at the expansion of the exception and the narrowing of the privilege by Congress in 2004, it eliminated the need for participation by a corporation, but it maintained the same definition of tax shelter. That is, a plan or arrangement, the purpose of which is to avoid or evade federal income tax. And when you look at the cross-reference 6662D of the statute, it's clear that the tax shelter will embrace the savings of tax for any person, not just corporations. Now, I think in the present case, there was no showing at all by the interveners that the exception did not apply. You know, we submit that just as the government in a summons enforcement proceeding, as was the case here, has to make a showing that there is no Justice Department referral in effect at the time the summons is issued or the proceeding begun by filing a declaration to that effect. By the same token, the interveners had an obligation to make a similar showing here. File a simple declaration or affidavit that the exception did not apply. That they have not done, even by their own lights and interpretation as they would have it. It was not for the government to prove that the exception did not apply, but this is an essential element of the privilege as to which they had the burden of proof. They simply failed to meet it.
Is that really clear from the structure of that statute? Couldn't you read that statute as really creating the privilege and then really making this an exception that the government would have to come forward on?
Well, I don't think the statute can be read that way, Your Honor. When you read it, as it defines, the exception, it's very clear as to what it says. If there's participation of any kind by a corporation in a shelter, it doesn't apply. Now, it wouldn't make any sense to put that burden on the government. We don't have access to the information. Indeed, in the context in which we're operating now, this is a summons enforcement proceeding. We're investigating. We're trying to get information. And there is no way that we could possibly meet that burden of proof. I mean, if you put the burden on the government, then, in effect, you read the exception out of the law. And we're not talking about anything major here. This is not a matter of saying they have to prove a negative. All we're saying is there has to be a minimal statement, minimal showing, a declaration or affidavit under oath that the exception doesn't apply. That was not done here. We urged upon the district court that they had to do that. They didn't do it. And the court, I think the court became very confused.
I'd like you to address that. Tell me about, from your perspective, how was the court confused? He covered this in a footnote, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, Judge Holderman does. And when you look at the footnote and the opinion, there are many references in the district court's opinions suggesting that the court regarded this as a discovery dispute, that the question of whether or not there was a tax shelter, participation in a tax shelter, was something to be decided at a later point in litigation. Well, this is a summary enforcement proceeding. We don't reach those issues. And I think the judge, when you look at the footnote, I think really had in mind the notion that at some point we'd be given the opportunity in this proceeding to demonstrate that there was a shelter here. And I think he had in mind an entirely different definition of tax shelter. I mean, it's undisputed that corporations took part in many, if not most, of these shelters. I think it's also undisputed that the purpose of these shelters was to avoid income tax. I mean, I think indeed the declaration of the IRS agent of Ello, provides evidence to that effect. And I don't think there's any serious dispute that that was the purpose of these shelters. So I think Judge Holderman was really very confused.
From a methodological point of view, how should he have proceeded?
Well, I think I think he should have asked himself whether the interveners, since they are the one claiming the privilege, have come forward and established all the elements. And I think in that regard, something as simple as what I've suggested is that he should have invited them to come forward with an affidavit or declaration that didn't apply. That's a very simple, straightforward thing. It's one, maybe two pieces of paper. I mean, this is not. That's all we're saying that has to be done in the first instance. Now, once that's done, of course, it'd be like a rebuttable presumption. If the government has other information or evidence to rebut it, we'd come forward with it.
You think he misapprehended what kind of tax shelters are implicated by the statute?
I think he did. I think he had a notion that somehow this had to be some, that we had to prove that there was something more here than just a plan to minimize or avoid, evade, whatever terminology you want, income tax. There's no question about that. That's what this was all about. That's why they paid substantial fees to these advisors to save income tax. That's the be-all and end-all of these shelters.
Don't we have a fundamental, I mean, I heard you just say that S corporations are the same as any other corporation, but isn't the corporation have to be the taxpayer?
Not at all. Not at all, Your Honor.
See, we are really a fundamental. That's just exactly 180 degrees from what your opponent says.
Well, that's true, and my answer is read the statute. When you look at the statute, the only reference to a corporate tax shelter is in the heading. And all that means is that if the tax shelter involves participation of a corporation, it's a corporate tax shelter. If Congress wanted to restrict it to a shelter which saved corporate taxes, it would have used a different reference. For example, 6111D, I believe it is, provides a definition of a tax shelter that speaks solely to a corporate shelter. The reference it used in 7525B, the reference that it maintained when it amended the statute in 2004, is a reference to a very broad definition of tax shelter. It's so broad that almost anything that may regard as a plan to save tax is a tax shelter for these purposes, and it's not restricted to corporate taxes. Furthermore, if Congress wanted to exclude S corporations or wanted to limit the exception to C corporations, it would have done so.
Well, isn't there? There are other provisions, at least one other provision, that actually makes reference to corporate income taxes in this context, correct?
In 7525?
Right. I'm just saying it was not adopted. The narrow definition in this particular statute we're discussing was not adopted.
That's
a broader
correct.
Definition.
That's
and
correct.
There are other places in the code where there's specific reference to corporate income tax.
Yes, such as 6111D, I believe it is, references corporate income tax. So you have a, you know, there's a very, the statute is very clear in making a choice between a narrower definition that pertains solely to corporate income tax and a very broad definition that refers to the savings of income tax of anybody. It's any person. If you look at the lead-in to the 6662D at the time, it talks about items of any person attributable to a tax shelter. And any person encompasses you, me, partnerships, well, partnerships are not taxpayers, other entities, corporations. It's extremely broad. It's not limited to corporations. Now, I'd like to speak to the question of the waiver with regard to the BDO memorandum. The district court, a rather remarkable and I think unprecedented decision, concluded that this document, which we don't dispute was privileged in the first instance, did not lose its privilege through waiver. The court applied the common interest doctrine. It's remarkable in that the only support, the only evidence in the record are what referred to as the his and her declarations. And it's not a matter of he said, she said, it's a matter of she said he couldn't remember. The thrust of the declarations, his declarations, was that I don't recall giving this, I don't recall turning this over. Now, the common interest doctrine presupposes an intentional action. It's not inadvertent. You can't have, there's a tension between claiming common interest for disclosure and claiming it was inadvertent. Her declaration was very specific. No, he gave it to me. I got it. We were trying to harmonize these positions vis-a-vis our common customers. Only after Judge Joyner in the Myron case brought up the common interest doctrine was there a third declaration offered in which for the first time he references or speaks of common interest. Given the nature of the record, I think it's remarkable that the court came out the way it did. I think it's also unprecedented in that I don't know of a single case, none are cited, where a party to the disclosure disavows having a common interest, and yet the doctrine was applied. I see I'm into my rebuttal time. Unless there are any questions, I'll...
Thank you, Mr. Seiler.
May it please the court. My name is David Autry. I represent the clients unto whom these privileges belong under Section 7525. If it would assist the court, I have a bench book that contains both the chart and the specific statute. To the extent we get into 7525, I'd be delighted to hand that up to the bailiff. My opposing counsel has no objection, as I understand it. If the court wishes to proceed with the statutes in the brief, I'd be pleased to do that.
Would you like to have that? You can hand that over to the bailiff, and the bailiff will make it available.
We wish to make 3 points on behalf of the clients. First is one defining the scope. Everyone agrees that Congress enacted this privilege, this statute, to cover and provide these clients with this privilege under Section 7525A, and everyone agrees that they qualify for the privilege under Section 7525A. The only question is the application of two exceptions. I will share, based upon certain questions that rose a moment ago, I think the law is quite clear that where a party seeks to draw an exception to a privilege, that party must bear the burden of proving the application of the exception. And the government is at no handicap here, is at no disability here, for you recall one of the first footnotes, I think it's footnote 4 in Judge Holderman's opinion, we voluntarily produce without objection 1,000 documents. The government submitted at least 5 declarations. And so in order, they're completely able, if they believe that an exception applies, to make out that. So that's our first point. The second point goes to what we, by way of code, refer to as the A40 document. And the point that we would make on that is that every civilized society for centuries, over more than a millennium, has recognized that decent people never presume fraud. And yet we're faced with an unworkable standard that does not distinguish between fraud and non-fraud based upon factors that we know, at least according to the Second Circuit, led to a conclusion that was clearly erroneous, factors that do not distinguish between fraud and no fraud. The government's brief speaks in terms of a colorable charge. All but in the vaguest of terms, we have no idea what the charge is. As we stand here today, we don't know what the elements are. We don't know what the fraud or the elements of the fraud is. We do not know what the crime or the elements of the crime is. And the Supreme Court's decision in Clark says there must be a prima facie case. There's no prima facie case on those elements. There must be a prima facie case on those elements. The very definition of prima facie is that it is sufficient to sustain the claim if there's no countervailing evidence considered.
Well, let's get back to 7525B. It sure doesn't contain the words corporate tax, does it?
It actually, Your Honor, it does.
Corporate tax.
Here, and it could be clearer. But if you start
but the bottom line, the words corporate tax, that would be a limiting factor, limiting language. That's not in there. I realize that it has direct or indirect participation of such corporation, but the words corporate tax are not in there.
No, but it's talking
limiting
about,
it to corporate
it's
tax.
Talking about such corporation, and if you go back a few more words, it talks about promotion. And I think the word promotion is the key. We're talking about, and we know that in the context of the very title of the statute, we're talking about the taxpayer, that an S corporation is not a taxpayer. And the way that Congress described B, reading it as a whole, it's directed towards tax shelters. And then in the text, when they talk about it, they're focusing upon the promotion of such corporation in a tax shelter. Well, if the corporation has no tax, there's no point of promotion. It's not being promoted. You're not going to promote an S corporation in a tax shelter. Tax shelter, if you look at 6662, is defined in terms of a significant purpose to avoid tax. There's no tax of such corporation to be promoted into this corporate tax shelter.
Well, the definition of tax shelter that applies to 7525B includes more taxpayers than just corporate taxpayers, doesn't it?
No, Your Honor. We say no. We say that there's no conflict between the title corporate tax shelters and B and the phrase in connection with the promotion of such corporation in a tax shelter. It's almost a geometric exercise. There's a broad universe of tax shelters. We're talking about the promotion of such corporation in that broad arena, the subset of promotions of corporations. Furthermore, there is no evidence in this record that suggests that there was promotion of such corporation in that tax shelter. And so the exception that the government seeks to apply fails for lack of evidence. And there would be no purpose to promote an S corporation. It's the promotion of an individual tax shelter or the promotion of a corporate tax shelter, not the promotion of a non-taxable entity.
Well, that's where we get right back to what I said. You're at 180 degrees with the government on this.
Yes, sir.
Whether or not S corporations are involved. And I gather you're relying from your brief at page 20, you're relying on some cases, Rollercade versus Commissioner, Taxpayer case.
It may help you in trying to divine what Congress's intention was here. Is there a rational basis for taking an S corporation and say it's which is a pass-through entity, a non-taxable, its affairs are passed through to its shareholders, and a partnership of people, and saying it's not subject. There's no rational basis for distinguishing between one pass-through entity and another pass-through entity, but that's precisely the irrational distinction the government says Congress was after here, despite the fact they speak in terms of the corporate tax shelter. Maybe a little bit of an emphasis in how one pronounces it, but that is our point, Your Honor. And that's the heart of the construction. The danger with the government's construction, and I'm going to get back to 840 in just a moment, is its breadth. Reflect upon this, if you would. I have a financial transaction under the government's definition, and it's a tax shelter because there's a significant purpose of tax avoidance. I submit to you that's why people consult with tax advisors, not to maximize their taxes, but to minimize their taxes. So a significant purpose of most financial transactions is to reduce, in consulting with my tax advisor, is to reduce my taxes. And they say if there's a direct or indirect participation by any corporation, why then it's a corporate tax shelter for these purposes, which would bring within the fold anyone with an IRA or 401k who has a corporate bank managing it, anyone with a corporate executor or corporate trustee, anyone with a principal residence mortgage that's through a corporation. There is no financial transaction I submit to you in America that's not touched directly or indirectly by some corporation. And so the distinction, if you read it in the government's way, consumes the entirety of the rule. It's got to be read in a different way. You may wonder, well, so what does the word indirect mean? It's talking about this situation. This statute was passed on July 22nd of 1998, is my recollection. It's focusing on corporate tax shelters, the leading of which was handed down by the tax court in a memorandum opinion by the name of ACM versus Commissioner involving the Colgate Corporation on March 5th of 1997, the prior year. Here's what indirect is talking about. We're talking about a corporate tax shelter. The tax shelter is not the corporation participating directly, but as a member in a partnership. So the tax benefits are coming through a partnership to shelter the corporate tax. That is what indirect means. There was a case pending at the time this was acted that was handed down the following month. ASA versus Commissioner, handed down the following month in another memorandum of opinion by the tax court, dealing with Allied Signal, focusing on corporate taxes. The focus was upon on corporate taxes. Having said that, if I could turn to A40. A40 is a circumstance where we know on its face the communicants, communicators in that document were focused on following Supreme Court authority directly on point. Supreme Court authority directly on point. Supreme Court authority, which, unlike this circumstance, deals with a sole purpose of tax avoidance. The Supreme Court said there, as other courts said, where the government alleged a sole tax purpose, not only is the taxpayer not negligent, there was no suggestion of negligence there, and certainly if he's not negligent, he's not fraudulent, he's right. Same is true in the Fifth Circuit case in Compact. Not only is the taxpayer not negligent there in following these things, there's nothing inappropriate about a tax avoidance purpose. This circuit has in northern Indiana public services the same principle embedded. And certainly he's not negligent. If he's not negligent, he's not fraudulent. He's right. Same is true in IES out of the Third Circuit. Same is true out of UPS where it says it's a permissible purpose completely compatible with a business purpose. And yet in a document that has a specific, explicit following of Supreme Court authority and a permissible purpose, a focus upon the tax purposes by the tax advisors doing exactly what they're asked to do, we're facing a crime fraud. Why are we facing a crime fraud? This is the one part, you know, poor Judge Holderman, this is the one part of the case. He looks at the factors available under the existing law. He embeds it. All of these factors can almost verbatim be drawn from Denny. He extracts those factors and applies them here. They do not distinguish between fraud and non-fraud. Then Denny is reversed by the Second Circuit. And so what is he to do? He is left with this proposition of it's in the totality of the circumstances. I submit to you that the totality of circumstances says how much but gives a district court judge no guidance. We ask that you reverse because the exceptions and structural strength of this statute ought to be honored. If it is true that one with the Supreme Court authority and permissible purpose is guilty of fraud, I submit to you that no case is safe from crime fraud allegations. If it is true that any significant tax purpose coupled with any participation by a corporation, no financial transaction, indeed most of us in this room who have IRAs and 401ks are engaged in corporate tax shelters. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kerry Samowitz, DLA Piper. I'm here for Pelley BDO to argue that the Karakish Memorandum at issue, which the government concedes is privileged, should remain privileged. Just at the outset, the government stated to you that it's unprecedented what Judge Holderman held that the document should remain privileged. It's not unprecedented. In fact, three other judges have held also that it should remain privileged. And under any deferential standard of review I should apply here, Judge Holderman's ruling should be affirmed. Just stepping back for a moment, Your Honors, I think it gets lost in the shuffle of the charges in this case, but the Karakish Memorandum is a classic example of a document which should be privileged. It was a document looking at a complex series of IRS regulations and a draft notice that had gotten issued that very day. The memo on its face reflects past communications from outside counsel. It analyzes the new rulemaking, poses questions, is very candid about strengths and weaknesses, and explicitly asks counsel, outside counsel, for advice on dealing with the new rulemaking. Just a classic example of a privileged document, and no doubt why the government wants access to it so badly. Judge Holderman reviewed the document and he reviewed as well hundreds of additional documents, as you heard from the earlier arguments, pertaining to BDO and BDO's clients. BDO, it is apparent that BDO did disclose this document to the law firm of Jenkins and Gilchrist. The circumstances of that disclosure are in dispute. Jenkins and Gilchrist and BDO shared common clients, and they shared the precise issues discussed in the memorandum of how to deal with this IRS rulemaking. Judge Holderman, after reviewing the hundreds of documents, after reviewing declarations from the government setting forth more documents, concluded that Jenkins and BDO, in facing the same issues, had a common interest in providing service to their clients, and accordingly, that any disclosure of this memorandum was protected by the common interest privilege. The government does not deny that the common interest privilege exists. What the government is charged is that one of the persons involved, the Jenkins-Gilchrist attorney, years later submitted an affidavit saying that, in her opinion, there was not a privilege there. But, Your Honors, the question is not what does somebody say years after the fact. The question is what were the discussions at the time. Judge Holderman reviewed those discussions, he reviewed the communications, and concluded that the parties had a common interest in defending against possible IRS rulemaking and actions. Even the affidavit from the Jenkins and Gilchrist attorney that's been referred to, even that affidavit references discussions that the parties were having. So there's no dispute there that they were discussing common issues that should not be disclosed to the wide world. The government also says there's a tension between BDO's suggestion that the document was inadvertently disclosed and BDO's suggestion that if it was disclosed, the common interest doctrine should protect it. But there's really no tension. Years later, BDO, to its best recollection, doesn't recall sending over the document, and all the circumstances of its disclosure as it is apparent on the fax transmittal information shows that there's a question as to how it was transmitted. But if it was transmitted deliberately, it clearly wasn't done so as a sport or for entertainment value. It could only have been transmitted as part of this ongoing discussions that Jenkins and Gilchrist and BDO were having. In any privileged situation with a common interest, you don't necessarily recall everything you've done, but you recall the fact that you were having discussions and that you consider those discussions to be for the purposes of servicing joint clients. So I think that Judge Holderman came to the correct conclusion. I think his alternate conclusion that the law of the circuit would protect an inadvertent disclosure also was a sound one. I think in this kind of situation, what is very helpful is the case law that this court has issued in terms of the standard of review. And this court, in the Railing case, in the Bland case, in the Frederick case, consistently has said that when the court is reviewing a privilege determination, particularly when mixed questions of fact and law are involved, that the court should be deferential to the lower court's findings, that the clearly erroneous standard should apply. And I think in particular this situation, where Judge Holderman has reviewed more documents involving my clients and Jenkins and Gilchrist and their joint clients than any other jurist in the country, application of the clearly erroneous standard and deference to his holdings is very appropriate. The government is also charged that the crime fraud exception should apply. They haven't argued it today. I think we've set that forth in the papers. I would refer the court to its recently issued Mattinson opinion, which discussed the standard for crime fraud and also emphasized that the government's charge that there's a tension between a statement in the memorandum and a filing years later in the litigation is not any kind of indicator of fraud. To the contrary, it's not surprising to find a tension between an internal document and a court filing. That's why we have a privilege, so that people, clients, and lawyers can engage in frank discussions in their internal work product. The government also, in its crime fraud allegation, relies on alleged vagueness. That is an issue that was rejected by the Denny Court. And I would just note that it's not a similar issue. It's not an issue by analogy. It was the precise same issue that the Second Circuit unanimously said was not a problem, was not any kind of an indicator of fraud. And again, under any kind of deferential standard, if you have the entire Second Circuit saying that there's no problem there, I think this court should agree. Unless the court has any questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
How much time is it, Mr. Seil? Sir, you have 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. With regard to the question of why an S corporation might be promoted as a participant in a tax shelter, there's a very obvious reason. It provides cover. The tax shelter industry depends upon stealth for its viability. And one thing the use of an S corporation does is it provides a cover for the individual taxpayer, because he just gets a K-1 from the S corporation, puts a number down on his return, and it's not apparent what gave rise to those losses. Further, if Mr. Autry is correct in his expansive interpretation, I take it he would have to agree that after 2004, there no longer is a 75-25 privilege, because clearly that amendment took corporate participation out of the picture entirely. I dare say, I think he's overreaching a bit and engaging some hyperbole in talking about the extent of our position with regard to the nature of the exception and how it should be interpreted. I think certainly for anyone who comes in seeking advice in a workaday situation, there's every reason to believe they could claim the privilege and not fall within the exception. Further, as far as the exception is concerned, it's undisputed that many of these shelters involve corporations. There's no question about that. There's a go back and forth on whether they have to be anything other than S corporations, but that's in the record. And the fact of the matter is, as I said, there was no minimal showing on their part, no statement, no declaration, no affidavit that the exception didn't apply. With regard to the Caracas memo, I said it was unprecedented. I was referring to the treatment of the memo. Granted, there are a few other district courts that reached the same result as Judge Holderman. What's amazing to me is that, when I say it's unprecedented, when you look at common interest or joint defense, almost inevitably or inevitably, it's a situation where you have the parties either engaging the same lawyer, seeking guidance to take for their position vis-a-vis the outside world or some such. What we have here is a situation where we have BDO and Jenkins and Gilchrist purporting to provide advice to common clients. Now, when I was in private practice and I gave advice to a client, I didn't regard myself as mounting a defense against that client. You know, and we're not talking about a situation here. White and Case was not representing BDO and Jenkins and Gilchrist. Jenkins and Gilchrist was not representing BDO. You know, they were trying to put together a common position in these opinions. Final point, as I'm running out of time here, is that there's no evidence of an agreement at the time the disclosure was made. Talk about the affidavit. Her affidavits or declarations coming years after the fact. His declarations came equally long after the fact, and all we've got is a lot of "I can't recall." And absolutely no indication, there's nothing in the record to indicate there was an agreement on anything. Indeed, her declarations indicate they disagreed about the position they were going to take. I think that's all I have, unless the court has any questions.
I guess not. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Indeed, our thanks to all of the counsel in the case. The case will be taken under advisement.